is number 05-1866, the United States against Douglas M. Thigpen. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm kind of glad that we got a little earlier start than I had anticipated. My name is Joanna Christensen. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent Douglas Thigpen in this matter. The issue before the court this afternoon is whether the district court erroneously considered improper information in determining Mr. Thigpen was a career offender. This issue is squarely presented under Shepard, and of course Taylor before Shepard, and Lewis, this court's decision of a little bit more than a year ago. Interestingly, the government doesn't address Lewis and doesn't cite Shepard, which I cannot explain, but that's where our argument falls today, squarely under Shepard. In this case, the district court relied on three convictions for the career offender. The first is a robbery conviction that was proven by using an indictment, and we're not questioning that conviction.
Before you go any further with the merits, perhaps you'd like to address the waiver argument, which
sure.
probably accounts for the reason why the government didn't specifically address those cases. Whether that's the explanation or not, there has been a waiver argument advanced.
Yes, and I can certainly address that argument. The government essentially argues that Mr. Thigpen admitted he was a career offender. We acknowledge that he did that. He did that in the first sentencing memorandum that was filed, which was actually filed prior to Shepard. After Shepard was decided, before sentencing, Mr. Thigpen filed another sentencing memorandum, which specifically objected based on Shepard. And objected to the two convictions that are at issue here, the drug offense and the battery offense. It wasn't probably the most artful objection ever made, but it was sufficient enough to preserve error in this case. And further, at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Thigpen himself repeatedly objected to the convictions.
Well, it was my understanding at the sentencing hearing, Mr. Thigpen's counsel withdrew any prior objection and stood on what was represented in the pre-sentence, and Mr. Thigpen made an Almendarez-Torres sort of objection, but nothing more. I know it's kind of a messy transcript, but
it's very unclear, and I think part of the confusion is Mr. Thigpen also filed a pro se objection to the pre-sentence report, which is primarily based on Apprendi and Almendarez-Torres. And but also has in it references to Shepard-like arguments. And I think the confusion is Mr. Thigpen believed that Apprendi and Almendarez-Torres and Shepard were related. That's not the correct legal argument, as this court is aware. But as far as what counsel said, counsel seemed to say, well, we may be admitting that. I don't know. Let me ask Mr. Thigpen. Mr. Thigpen says, no, I'm not going to admit anything. It's not a very clear preservation. It, of course, would have been better if an argument had been made on the facts and case law that was appropriate. It wasn't, but the district court asked if there were further objections aside from what Mr. Thigpen had argued, and counsel said no, there weren't. I believe that caveat is enough to preclude this from a waiver situation. If this court feels that it has not been appropriately preserved, my argument would be that it has not been waived, that it's been forfeited. And the Fifth Circuit decided in Garza-Lopez, which I cited in my brief, that this type of issue, the Shepard issue, is plain error, and it affects the defendant's substantial rights, and reversed under very similar facts, where the defendant possibly had not made an appropriate objection in the district court. So I'll move on, talk slightly about the facts and what happened. There are two offenses that are issue, a drug offense and a battery offense. For the drug offense, the district court relied on an arrest report from the Chicago Police Department. And for the battery offense, the district court relied on a statement of facts by the state's attorney's office. I believe that under Shepard, the arrest report used for the possession offense is very similar to what was used in Shepard and what the, I'm sorry, not Shepard. Lewis is very similar to that. In Lewis, the case used an affidavit from the state that was attached to the complaint that's very similar to what was attached to the battery offense in this case. The Supreme Court has specifically said that a categorical approach needs to be taken in these cases, and that includes looking at, when it's a guilty plea, the plea colloquy, a plea agreement if there was one, or other similar memorization or memorialization of the facts in the case.
With respect to these two offenses, did the district court look at appropriate material as well as inappropriate material? Did it look at any of the materials that would be sanctioned by Shepard and its predecessors?
Well, it's not exactly clear from the record. What the district court said was, I've looked at the material that was submitted with the government's version of the offense with the pre-sentence report. That material contains all of the criminal history records that Mr. Thigpen has managed to amass, which is a fair amount of material. It includes both appropriate materials and inappropriate materials. The district court did not specifically say one way or another, but we believe that under Lewis that the fact that it's clear in the pre-sentence report that inappropriate materials were used, and the district court clearly considered the pre-sentence report, that the court has considered inappropriate materials.
There was appropriate material used as well to establish the fact of conviction.
Not by the pre-sentence report. And certainly not mentioned by the district court. District court mentioned what was in the pre-sentence report specifically.
He mentioned that, but that's where I go back to the point. Was there appropriate material as well in the record for the district court to refer to?
There was appropriate material about both offenses that was in the record. It is not exactly clear what the convictions are, particularly with regard to the battery offense.
Can we look at that material and say this looks like it's appropriate to us and be done with it?
That would be similar to a harmless error analysis that, you know, well, we're looking at this, and even though we look at it, it's clear he's a career offender. And it seems to me under Lewis that that's not the issue.
Why not?
This court said in Lewis that when the district court considers those inappropriate materials, it may have affected the court in its sentencing decision.
Is that part of Lewis correct?
Well, I would argue that it is. It seemed to be something that's followed both by the Fifth Circuit and then later by this court in Hagenau. It's a very similar argument that's been made.
Why can't I look at that to determine where in the range I want to put the guy?
Well, I think that even after Booker, we're still stuck with a sentencing situation where only reliable evidence can be used.
Well, but the degree of reliability is clearly different. I mean, the only reason the Supreme Court and Shepard and its predecessors has cabined the district court's discretion to certain material is because of the jury trial issue that lurks in the background. But when we come to a question of the severity or the of the conduct, and what that shows with respect to recidivism, we're not worried about the jury trial issue.
Correct.
So if I have an aggravated battery case, and I can only look at the Shepard approved material to decide whether it can be counted or not, that's fine. But can't I look at other material produced by some other court to find out whether the defendant cut the victim up into smithereens and therefore is a very dangerous guy that I ought to go to as far down as I can in sentencing because I don't want him out again?
Well, in most sentencing contexts, I would agree with you. And if it weren't a career offender or in, you know, an armed career criminal situation, it seems as if the court could consider those things. I don't know why the Supreme Court has made what seems to be a developing exception in career offender cases and armed career criminal cases. That's what it seems to be saying to me in Shepard and what this court then said in Lewis.
Of course, here, he was sentenced at the bottom of the range.
That's correct.
So if there's evidence in the record that indicates that Shepard approved and that indicates that these offenses were committed, what harm?
I believe the harm goes back to the Lewis situation. If in the transcript, when Judge Shader sentenced Mr. Thigpen, he was reluctant even to sentence him at the bottom of the range and was hesitant about that and ultimately did, making some reference to this court's post-Booker precedent, it may have influenced him, the inappropriate materials. It may have been in the back of his mind when he was making the sentence, and it's possible he would have gone below the guideline range.
But that would have been appropriate under 3553A.
Correct.
I mean, that's another way of asking the question that Judge Ripple was driving at here. There's a distinction, a legal distinction, between application of the recidivist enhancement and the appropriate materials to consider when calculating that, and a straightforward application of 3553 factors, which can include the waterfront of evidence, including what was examined here.
I think the best answer I have to that question, to kind of harmonize Lewis and 3553A, is that we come back to a reliability issue, and perhaps what Lewis is based on is that those types of documents are not as reliable and not entitled to the type of weight that Shepherd-approved documents are. I see my time is up. Thank you.
May it please the Court. I'm Brandon Fox on behalf of the United States. Good afternoon. I want to touch on the first issue, actually the last issue, that my colleague just addressed, and this is the reliability issue. And I don't think that the defendant can now complain about these materials being used by the court to determine where in the range or where outside of the range under 3553A that the sentence should have fallen, when it was the defendant who argued in favor of mitigation by presenting these facts to the judge. The defendant looked at the arrest reports and said, "Judge, look at the facts here. These might be crimes of violence, but they are relatively low-scale crimes of violence." So now on appeal, after muddying up the record, they're now arguing that these materials were not reliable when they were the ones that wanted to use them in the first place. To then touch on the harm analysis, there is no harm here. As a matter of law, these three offenses were qualifying offenses for the career offender purposes. And so what the defense really wants is to have this case remanded to the district court, where the district court would commit error if he did anything else but say that these three offenses were qualifying offenses and that the defendant was a career offender.
So they're qualified on their face?
Correct. As a matter of law, if you look at their elements, and that's what the judge is required to do, look at their elements, there is the threat of violence, the threat of force, or the attempted threat of force, and also the drug offense, that it was a possession with the intent to distribute offense. So these on their face, by what he was charged with and convicted of, they were qualifying offenses. That's correct. So there's really no issue before us here. This is really much ado about nothing because, again, if we were to reverse it, the judge would be obligated to find that he's a career offender. So we're stuck in a very strange situation where the defendant admitted below that he was a career offender, admitted during the transcript of the sentencing hearing that he had no disagreement with the court's determination that each offense itself was a qualifying offense, and was only objecting to whether he was the individual who committed that offense and whether we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt and whether we put into the indictment that he was a career offender. That's what he was contesting. I think that's pretty clear from the record that was the case. They didn't say, "Judge, you're not supposed to consider these materials under Shepherd," and that's the reason why we didn't cite it to it in our brief. This is not a Shepherd issue here. This is, first of all, a waiver issue, and secondly, an issue of the judge using what he was supposed to use, looking at the elements of the offenses to determine whether these were qualifying offenses. So, again, this issue is much ado about nothing. And unless there are further questions, I know that I have a lot of time left. But
may I ask you about the problem with the restitution? I just have a very hard time seeing how the Day case has been complied with here. I mean, you give it kind of a passing obey sans in your brief, but don't really discuss its requirements. And it just seems to me that the district court here just didn't disregard it.
The Day case says that the judge cannot has to consider the defendant's ability to pay, and then after that cannot let the probation officer determine the payment of restitution, that schedule. And here the district court did not do that. What the district court did was first saying in the order, having determined the defendant's ability to pay, I find that of course, the $100 special assessment is due and payable immediately, as is required by statute, and that the bulk of it is due within 60 days. So he has set a schedule. He has said that it's due in 60 days. He's not saying it's pay and doable immediately.
If I recall, Day had quite a discussion about what due and payable meant as opposed to scheduling the payments.
Okay.
And that distinction, it seems to me, Judge Shader just absolutely disregarded. And you seem to be arguing that you'd like the case law of the circuit and how we write this case out to sanction that disregard of Day. That seems to be the government's position. And that's what I'm, frankly, a little bit annoyed about since I spent a lot of time writing Day.
Your Honor,
I mean, you're trying to seems to me the government's trying to give it a very unceremonious burial.
Your Honor, we respect Day, of course, and we just think that the judge here did comply with it when he's saying sentencing an individual to 168 months in prison, recognizing that he's going to be in prison and there's no interest that he's instituting as a result. So there's not going to be a harm to the defendant by saying, I think it works out to $13 a month is what he's going to have to pay if it is worked out that way. So I don't think that it's the same situation as someone who's going to be on supervised release, let's say for 3 or 5 years coming up very soon, and has a huge amount of money to pay. This is $2,200 over a period of 168 months. And the judge did state in his order, there was no objection to this, of course, and I know Day is also a plain error analysis. Excuse me, but there's no objection to the district court, so we don't feel that they hit the plain error analysis.
Except the fact of the matter is this can really work to the detriment of the defendant later on if he doesn't pay it, doesn't it?
In a different circumstance, that might be the case, but when we're talking about $2,200 over 168 months with no interest, I don't see how $13 a month really can affect him that greatly in the future. So,
if given a precise schedule, he could, and he adhered to it, it may make a very big difference in terms of his placement. It may make a difference when he's on supervised release.
Again, I don't know the exact amount that defendants get while they're in prison, the prisoners get, but if I remember correctly, I have seen situations where they've been ordered to pay $25 a month based on only what they're getting.
All the district judge had to do was write it out.
Your Honor, again, we believe that they do not meet the plain error analysis under the Day opinion, and respect to your opinion, of course. Okay.
If I could just clarify, I thought that the judge's order was that the restitution was due and payable in 60 days, not over the course of the entire incarceration of the defendant.
That's correct, Your Honor, and all I'm saying is that the way it will actually happen, I guess I'm talking about how it's probably going to happen, is it's due in 60 days. He's been in prison. He has been in prison since the day of his arrest. But there will be, I mean, he will have to pay some sort of fee over the course of his incarceration, or he'll owe that when he comes out of prison in 13 years. So we don't know what the schedule is, but that's where we stand with the record. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Did Ms. Christensen have any time left? If you'd like to just take a minute, Ms. Christensen, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address first the argument that it doesn't matter. Our argument doesn't matter because categorically possession with intent and aggravated battery are crimes of violence and drug trafficking crimes under career offender. That's the exact argument the government made in Lewis, that it didn't matter because robbery is always a crime of violence, so this person's a career offender. And that's also the argument this court rejected in Lewis. I'll talk just briefly about the restitution payment schedule. I think it's fairly clear from the order the judge didn't set a payment schedule, and from Day the judge is required to do so. As a matter of fact, this type of order, we've appealed this issue at least 20 times since Day was decided almost a year ago. The government has conceded that issue 19 of those times, and their order is almost identical to this. So it is an error. There is no payment schedule. Day says there has to be a payment schedule, and we believe that's fairly straightforward from the judgment order in this case. even if that's not the case, as you know, there's an error in it because the penalties just says $100. It should say $2,100. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. And the case will be taken under advisement. The court has finished the call of the day and has also finished the regular scheduled cases for April term in 2006. And so, with the exception of our short argument days, the court wishes the bar a very happy summer.